From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm sorry for that technical glitch there. Thanks, Wade, for getting me on the air. So this is Tell the Truth Faster. I'm a licensed psychotherapist, and every week we deal with issues relating to mental health, emotional health, spiritual health. I deal with a holistic perspective, which means finding balance in body, mind, and spirit in our lives. Now, the question, we all know that the truth will set you free, but the question we ask here is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? So, this week, we're going to be dealing with something very current, and we're going to be dealing with current events. And I've done a show related to this topic a couple of times before over the last few years. But as a therapist, I find in my personal life as well as with clients that what's going on in the world has so much more impact on the emotional and psychological and spiritual well-being or lack of well-being in our lives than most people think. And a lot of therapists, I don't think, attend to these issues near as much as I think they need to. Back after the 2000 election, I wrote an article that you can actually read in its entirety on my website, tellthetruthfaster.com. And if you go to articles and you look up the article on emotion-related depression, kind of a takeoff on the diagnostic manual. And I'm going to actually read the last paragraph, even though I closed the article with that. It's a good way to open the show and set the tone. And I'm quoting myself here when I say, "It is events in our clients' lives that drive them to seek therapy. Those events could be personal childhood abuse, death of a loved one, history of addictions, and so many other things that scar and damage the psyche, the heart, the mind, and the soul. Despite Bayard Rustin's statement that history is not an accident, that history is not a choice in a practical sense, history as choice is the conscious decisions we make today that is creating our future history. The powers that be in Florida and the Supreme Court, I believe, let us down. We have a system that really works, even if it loses its way from time to time. We have minds and hearts that really take care of us, even if they lose their way from time to time. As therapists, we are there to be conscious lights to help people rediscover their way, whatever that may be. As human beings, part of a society, I feel I have a similar charge." Now, I wrote that, obviously, after the 2000 election, when I actually noticed my own sense of depression and overwhelm and a heaviness. And I believe after the 2000 election, whether you were Democrat or Republican or independent, you felt the heaviness of that period, of the fighting that went on, of the name-calling that went on, of the the stress that was entailed with the weeks and weeks of not knowing the outcome of an election and the questions that I think still exist today in the legitimacy of that election. But we're now 6 years beyond that. And in 2004, there were questions again. And I believe Republicans were cheering and Democrats were crying. So now we have an election where the tables are turned, a certain amount turned, where as a Democrat, as a progressive myself, I'm rather pleased that there's going to be more of a balance of power in this country than there has been for the last 6 years, but it's a cautious one. And I believe that a lot of Republicans out there may not be surprised by what happened, but I still believe many of them are in the same state of shock that many of us were in the last two presidential elections. So if you look at that, if you look at us living in wartime and the impact that war has and the news that we see daily, what does that do to you when you're watching news like we see, whether it's about the Iraqi war, whether it's about terrorism, whether it's about shootings in our own communities, whether it's about poverty and ignorance and problems in the school system? What kind of impact does that have on an individual? What kind of impact does that daily news report have on a community? A sense of hope or hopelessness, a sense of excitement or depression, you know, different things for different people. But what's important is that we start to realize that what's going on in the world around us, whether it's an election or just news, impacts who we are as human beings, affects our relationships. When we're depressed or stressed over a war that's being fought or over conflict that's going on in our own local community, don't you think we bring that home to the relationships that we have under our own roof? Whether your partner and you agree on the same issues or disagree, the darkness and the weight or the elation and the celebration are things that come under your own roof. So I'm one of those therapists that when someone's coming into me and I'm getting some background, over time I get to know whether the stress that they're dealing with is relative to what went on decades ago in their childhood or what went on in terms of a traumatic event maybe a few years ago or more recently. But certain things that's going on in the world and in their world are also triggering reactions or affecting their ability to cope or not cope with the news. I've said this before many times over the air. One thing that I stopped doing a long time ago, and I really advise people to not do, is to stop listening to the 11 o'clock news on television. It is so important to me that that's not what the last thing I've heard or seen before I put my head down on the pillow and try and get a sound, deep sleep that's going to be healing and nurturing. So it's very important that we're not listening. I mean, it used to be that I'd drive in my car and I'd listen to the news radio stations, which basically repeat the same news every 15, 20 minutes over and over and over again. And yet I found that I was riding for a few hours listening to the same news reports over and over and over again. I mean, how insane is that? Because most of it was not particularly good. And they make a big deal out of every little thing. So it impacts us even more. It's just an issue of you looking at your own life and taking personal responsibility for what is bombarding you. Now let's look at the elections, because I'm going to introduce a guest in just a few minutes who is part of the political process very directly, because she's a politician herself. And so we're looking at what's going on in Washington, and we know that the Democrats have just by a slim margin have taken back the Senate, which means they're going to have a little bit more power than they used to have. And they certainly have a much better margin in the House, and they've taken back control of the House. But you know what? As a Democrat, I'm also very cautious about this. I like the idea of breathing a little easier because, like I said, there's more checks and balances going on right now. But it's very important that there's not a lot of gloating going on like the Republicans called it a mandate. The 2004 election Bush was calling a mandate, even though it was as slim a margin practically as it was in 2000. So I haven't heard Bush say that there's a mandate that the Democrats have control now, you know, but it was a mandate when he got reelected by the same conflict that went on in 2000. We're not here to relive 2000, 2004, but we are here to take a look at what is going on, how it's impacting us. Now, if you want to call in, we're doing the show live tonight. If you're in the Phoenix area, the number is 480-949-1310. That's 480-949-1310. If you're listening via the Internet, as I know some of you are, same number, it's a toll number, but with today's plans, it's probably free for you to call Phoenix anyway. 480-949-1310. Now, to move right into the important part of the show, which means bringing on my guest. My guest tonight is a woman who I greatly admire. I wouldn't have asked her to be on the show tonight. Her name is Abby Land. And Abby is she's a council member for the city of West Hollywood in California. She's also a co-CEO of the Los Angeles Free Clinic. And Abby actually ran for the California State Assembly in the primary a number of months ago and did not win that election, although I felt she should have, and she had my support, and she still has my support. But Abby, you know, I could tell you all the things that Abby has done in terms of what she's done politically, but I want to introduce her more along the lines of who I see her as an individual. I see her as an individual who is a rare politician, a politician who really walks the walk and talks the talk of what it means to have a commitment to community service and do it through the political system. You can see that by her job with the LA Free Clinic, but you could see it so much as you get to know her, as I introduce her, in terms of all the other things she's done in the community. She's a politician that I experience with a high consciousness and a high sense of integrity and not very much ego. And that's almost a contradiction in terms when you think of politicians, because you usually think of politicians as ego-based. And Abby is somebody that I just being in her presence, you can feel the genuineness and the honesty and integrity with which she functions in all aspects of her life. So with that being said, Abby, you there? I really want to welcome you to tonight's show and glad you're taking the time on a Friday night to do this.
Well, Stuart, thank you so much. That was so many nice words. I'm speechless.
Well, you and I have not socialized a lot together, but the reason I supported your primary run and I heard you were running is just because of what I just said, because of who I believe you to be, and because I put such stock in the people that we both know, like Allison Morgan and Park Skelton, anybody that they support, I know, has a different level of functioning as a politician. So
well,
I'm really glad
so
you're
much.
With us tonight.
I'm really glad to be here.
Tell us a little bit more. I mean, as a council person for the city of West Hollywood, you've been doing that for a number of years. What's that about for you? I mean, it's a local community city council, but you've been very dedicated to the city of West Hollywood for a long time. What does that entail, being on a city council for a small community like that?
Well, I think being on a city council, it entails the same things no matter whether you have a large community or a small community, because really it's about, to me, meeting the needs of people and caring enough about where you live and wanting to make sure that it is as good as it can get. And so, you know, I don't think it actually matters the size of your jurisdiction. I think what matters is your commitment and why you're there.
Mm-hmm. How long have you been on the council?
I have been on the council for a number of years, as you said. I served from 86 to 97, and then I took a little break, and I came back in 2003, and I've been serving ever since then. And for me, the city, I serve on city council because I think West Hollywood is an incredible city and an incredible community. We are a community that espouses the very things that I believe in. We are a city that cares about its citizens. We probably spend more per capita on social services for our community than most cities. We're a city that takes stands on important issues. We're a pro-choice city. We're a city that came out against the war. We're a city that one of our council members at every council meeting adjourns in memory of the people who lost their lives in the war from our region. We're a city that I believe walks the walk and talks the talk, or talks the talk and walks the walk. And you know, it's a wonderful community, and I serve as a council member. It's a privilege to be able to represent a community that, you know, we share each other's values.
And for a relatively small community, it's an extremely diverse community. I mean, people here in West Hollywood, they think the whole community is gay and lesbian people. You know, it's called Boys Town for a reason.
And, right.
And yet you're heterosexual, you're married, and the council is representative of the diversity, and the community has a large percentage of gay and lesbian residents, but also has a very large Russian community, Jewish Orthodox community, and elderly and senior community. So it's a very strange mix to be able to be the politician that has to balance the needs of so many different types of people, wouldn't you say?
It at times is challenging, but I think you captured the very heart of West Hollywood, which is it is this diverse community with people that, if you saw all of our names and nationalities written on a piece of paper, you'd think, oh my God, they must never get along. But the truth is we do, because I think a lot of us hold the same values.
Mm-hmm.
It's about having people be equal. It's about having people get the services they need so they can enjoy a quality of life. And it's about being inclusive. And, you know, so I think that that's what drives the community, and it's why we have this incredible diversity. And people, when they get to know the community, are kind of always amazed that we all can live together and work together as well as we do. But we do.
And I have a, you know, back in the early 90s, I was doing a lot of work in the former Soviet Union, in Russia in particular, doing AIDS work back then.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember that.
Yes, I do.
And I know how conservative-minded the Russian world is in terms of homosexuality. I mean, they think it is sick and, you know, a sin against God and all this other stuff. And now you have all these emigres. In the early 90s, I remember being at the Gay Pride Parade and seeing this culture shock on the look of all these Russian emigres that were watching the Gay Pride Parade. And yet they weren't angry about it. It was like this sense of newness and this sense that time to consider that what they were taught may not necessarily be the belief all over the world. And what I was seeing and what I get from a lot of the Russian emigres is that there's been a real expansion of their minds and their belief systems by being exposed to one another.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. There is a willingness to learn, or a willingness to just accept, even if you might not believe in everything that's going on around you. And we've certainly, I think, as a community, have worked to have our Russian residents understand who we are and what it is that we hold of value. And you're right. I mean, clearly in Russia, I mean, homophobia is a crime. You know, I mean, homophobia runs rampant.
Homosexuality is a crime.
And homosexuality is a crime. Well, homophobia should be a crime too. But,
right.
but homosexuality, I mean, is a crime, and so for people to come and begin to understand that it's okay, that's quite a leap. And people, for the most part, make that leap. And, you know, I don't want to paint this picture that it's you know, all hunky-dory. I mean, certainly there are people here who have homophobia, and there are people mm-hmm. who put up with things, but they might not like it. But nevertheless, for the most part, it's a community that is willing to accept, and I think even for the folks from the former Soviet Union who came from a place where it wasn't okay, the freedom that they enjoy here in America is so different that they are willing to be open-minded to kind of what freedom means in the broadest sense. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think part of it also is that the council and the entire city government, I think, gives everybody a sense that they're really being listened to. So even if they have concerns or complaints, there's somebody actually paying attention to them and not ignoring them. And,
I think that's true.
Yeah.
And I think that might be a difference in a smaller community where you have an opportunity. You know, I say sometimes I go to the local grocery store, I think they should be charging me office space because I do so much business, you know, as I'm walking the aisles, because people, you know, see me, I see them, and they have an issue, and they'll say, you know, I hate to interrupt, but, and they'll tell me what's going on their street or whatever, and, you know, it's great. So it's a very accessible government, and those of us who serve on the council and our department directors are fairly accessible. Obviously, as council members, we live here, and for city staff, a number of city staff live in the community, and so people know you. And we try to, I think, we've set it up so that you would feel comfortable coming up to one of us and talking to us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some cities there's a lot more formality, and we're fairly casual in our approach to government.
Well, it's kind of a small town feel to it.
Yeah.
So back in 2004, I also did a show called When an Election Does Not Go Your Way. And my guest then was Miguel Bustos, who ran for the city council in San Francisco and lost his district election. Now, you recently had a similar experience running in the primary for a state assembly seat, which basically meant if you won the primary, you basically were going to win the general election because it's a pretty Democratic district. What
Correct.
Was that experience like for you? And I want to get on a personal level with it, if you're willing, in terms of what the race was like for you emotionally and psychologically, and what was it like to deal with not being the winner of that race?
Those are good questions. Well, I will say, and I'm not
trying to ask good questions.
Well, one of the things is, I mean, anytime you run a race, you have to recognize that, you know, someone's going to win and someone's going to lose. And so I have to say that before I finally made the final decision, I had to somehow run through the scenarios in my head of how would it feel if I won and how would it feel if I lost and would I be okay. So, you know, I did that. I can't tell you exactly what that process was because I don't, you know, it's just a process. But I kind of thought I would be okay if I didn't lose. But with that said, when you
are running.
I mean, if
you didn't win.
Yeah, I mean, when you right, if I didn't win, sorry. But when you're running, obviously you're running to win. And, you know, elections and running for office is truly an emotional roller coaster because there are so many things at play. And you're running, I mean, they call it running because literally you're running from, you know, one event to the other and one issue to the other. And, I mean, it's a very good word. And so, but when you're running kind of at that speed for a period of time, you know, everything is front and center, if you mean. So, you know, the highs are highs and boy, the lows are lows. And it's just a bit of a roller coaster. And part of, I think personally, the challenge is to not have that ride be as dramatic as it can be some days. Because at the end of the day, you've got to function and you have to kind of try to keep things right in the middle as best as you can so you can, you know, kind of, quote, hold it together.
And that means your personal life, too, because what we see in politics all the time are these relationships that split up. you know, we look at Mark Foley. We look at other major dramas that play out in the media. I mean, all of a sudden, your life, your personal life is no longer personal, and your family no longer has a personal life. I mean, on more on the state and national scene than maybe on the local that you were running. But how does it impact even your family?
Yeah, I think running is very challenging for everyone who's close to you, from your family to the people you work with. It's a challenging time, and you know, it tries a relationship, because you know, I mean, you're not around sometimes, or there are times you'd rather be doing something else, but you've got an obligation, and you know, you can't always be present in your relationship. And then the other way, I think it tries it, quite honestly, is even when you are home, you're tired, you know. And so finding ways to be present is hard. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm really glad that somehow my husband and I keep surviving these things, and you know, we find ways to be present with each other. But it's really hard, and I'm not surprised that relationships fail.
Well, how have you and your husband worked it out?
The way we've worked it out is we make a commitment to talk to each other. We make a commitment to carve out some kind of time together. And, you know, and we acknowledge that, you know, the running isn't forever. You know, it's a period of time, and you'll get past it. And the good thing is we have our lives. My husband is an artist, and he spends, you know, a lot of time. Well, you know, it's not like we're joined at the hip. So he's busy anyway, which is really good. And, you know, and we try to make the best time of when we are together, and also to be judicious about, I think for us it works best in the sense that we have separate lives, and so we're judicious about you having each other. You know, there are things that he does where it's important that I'm with him, and I try to do that as best as I can, and there are times that I'm doing something and it's important, you know, it's like, oh, can you just be there for me that night? And he tries to do that as well. But yet we have our lives together, so that we're not both kind of sucked into that frenzy of a campaign.
Mm-hmm. There's something else you were going to say, and it did before I asked that last question. There was a two-part answer I heard coming out of you.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember
remember?
The other part
okay.
was. Oh, I don't remember what the other part is. I think the other part about a campaign, which is just challenging, is, you know, it's in many ways, without you wanting it to be, but it's kind of all about you. It's about the issues, but you're the one that's talking about the issues.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of how you phrase the issues and how you interact with people. It's a lot about a campaign is about you. And I think that's hard on yourself, and it's hard on the people around you as well. You know, because even though, and you were so kind to say, don't have an ego. I mean, we all have some kind of ego.
We all have some kind, but it's
right.
not as
and,
bloated as we right. see with so many other politicians
right, exactly. and I don't make
who
my
do
decisions.
See themselves as the center of the universe, so they love when everything's about them.
Exactly. What? It's not about me? But I don't make my decisions from my ego. You know, I really work so hard to make my decisions based on what I think is best for the community, for the clinic, you know, whatever the decision is. And it's not, well, oh, God, if I did this, look where I would be. I don't make decisions like that. But, you know, during a campaign, it's so much because you're the one that's carrying that message. And I think, you know, I can't say how other people feel it, but there's a tremendous pressure on you, and for me, I take it very personally, and I take great responsibility that, God, people are really counting on me to do this, you know. People are really, like, they're saying they love, like, what I say, they like what I stand for, and now they're counting on me to win. So you feel, at least I do, a tremendous obligation to kind of deliver that for people. And, you know, so when you don't, you know, there's an intense disappointment that accompanies that loss.
How do you deal with the loss and the disappointment? How do you process it?
The way I processed it is I think this time I really worked on the fact that people seem genuinely glad that we worked together for something, and the people around me were, we all wanted to win, but the people around me were okay with not winning because we kept to our plan and we kept our integrity and we kept focusing on the issues during the campaign and didn't do a lot of negative stuff. And that was something that I didn't want to do. And and so we didn't for the most part. And so I think the way I processed it was I went back to what it is why I had really run, and I had run because there were issues I wanted to talk about and there was an expertise that I thought I could bring to the debate up in Sacramento. And though I didn't win, there's other ways to talk about those issues and there's other ways to bring that expertise. And I tried to focus more on that than, you know, kind of the personalness of it. And that kind of got me through. And as I said, I also had just so many people around me who were just really proud of the race that we ran. And we just didn't win, that's all. You know,
good attitude.
That you know, as I said to people, someone wins, someone loses. You like to win, but, you know, it's that. And I'm lucky. I have, you know, I have a whole life. I have a wonderful job at the L.A. Free Clinic, and I was able to keep that job. And I have this wonderful opportunity to serve here in the city of West Hollywood, and I'm still on city council, and, you know, I didn't lose my relationship, and, you know, so I just have, okay, something different for these next few years, that's all.
So let's take the conversation up to more of a national and maybe statewide level, because I want to get your opinion on what's going on with the shift slightly in favor of the Democrats being more in control. And I want to remind my listeners, if you want to call in, you have a question, you agree or disagree with something we're talking about, you want to make a comment and contribute to the show, the number is 480-949-1310, 480-949-1310. So we, you know, this show is airing in Phoenix. So during the last Senate election in when McCain ran the last time, one of the guests actually during when Kerry was running, I actually had the Democrat that was running against John McCain. His name was Stuart Starkey, a very wonderful middle school inner city teacher in the Phoenix area who just felt that the Democratic process called for there being at least two candidates and not just giving the election away. And if I lived in Phoenix, I would have voted for Stuart Starkey. I'm not a big fan of John McCain, to be honest with you. I think he's too much of an opportunist. And, you know, he's behind Bush to get him reelected. And then he says he's not behind Bush. And, you know, it's just too much flip-flopping, if to use a phrase that I hate. but anyway, there was that same level of genuineness and sincerity that Stuart Starkey brought that I was talking about with you. But look at the national picture right now. What's going on in this country, from your perspective, that seems to have been, for many years now, pulling itself apart in very destructive ways, and how is this last election, from your perspective, healing or not healing?
Well, first you need to know I am definitely a person that, for the most part, sees the glass half full. So when something good happens, I try to go with the good part of it. I'm not sure if the election was healing. What I believe is that the election showed that there is a shift, that people are wanting government to be more responsive. And I think the actions of government over the last few years, with us continuing a war that more and more people are against, with some of the actions in regards to, you know, quote, taking care of seniors and, you know, changing the drug prescriptions and these things, that at the end of the day, many people are not better off. And
well, even in terms of the war, Abby, you know, the way, you know, the government sends men and women over there to get killed and then reduces veterans' benefits.
It's the hypocrisy of the government. And so I believe this election was about really people saying, you know, I'm tired of this hypocrisy. I want more truth or consistency. You know, if you're going to send young people into battle, you need to send them with the proper uniforms and the proper training and give them a chance, for God's sakes. And then when they come home, you need to make sure that they are taken care of. And, you know, that's common sense. And I believe that the government has been looking way too self-serving, more like what's in it for me, mm-hmm. from the top of the ticket. And people rebelled. And I have to say, now, I do live in West Hollywood, and I do live in a district that's extremely Democratic. So I am a Democrat, and I'm a very strong, liberal, progressive Democrat. But I believe that those who aren't as liberal and progressive as I am, and many people from the middle, really voted to say they want a change. And there was some euphoria happening as those results were coming in and people saw that there was an opportunity to have something shift.
And where do you think it's going now?
Well, that is a good question. I mean, obviously, I hope the shift continues to happen. The Democrats have an agenda that they want to push through in the next 100 days and 100 hours, and, you know, they're going to be very aggressive, and we can hope that there's a process. I believe the Democratic agenda is agenda of people and about making things equal and making sure that people have a quality of life and have a chance. And so I think we're headed in a good direction. I think in 2008 we're going to see continued shifts. And even here in California, we did elect a Republican governor. He appeared during the campaign to be a middle-of-the-road governor.
Yeah, when he needed to be. And, you can see where I stand on him.
That's what people voted for. Uh-huh. You know, but that's what people voted for the most part. And yes, there's the star quality, and people, you know, probably voted in some ways for that as well. But with that said, they also voted pretty much all the statewide offices as Democrats except for one. So,
right.
Again, there is, and a number of the initiatives on our ballot that weren't about people didn't pass, and we passed bond measures to improve housing and transportation. I mean, people are desperate to see something change, so they feel like their needs are being taken care of. And I think it was, I hope, a wake-up call for the Republicans, not that I want them to be in power, you understand, but maybe to moderate some of what they are doing and to recognize that they have got to look out for people.
Well, you know, the day after the election, when I heard Bush speaking, it's the first time in 6 years I haven't seen the arrogance.
Yeah.
And there was, and I won't even say he was humble. I think he was just depressed and what he called forgetting a thumping.
But it's
the first time I just didn't see the arrogance, and my concern is that the Democrats in power now don't step into that arrogant role, you know, thinking
right.
that they have that control like the Republicans took over Congress in 94, and they did so with a real sense of arrogance.
Right. Well, I haven't seen that arrogance yet. I mean, Nancy Pelosi keeps talking about working together, both sides of the aisle needs to come together, and the numbers are both sides of the aisle do need to come together.
Mm-hmm.
I hope, though, that we as Democrats stick to our true ideals, and I do feel that we have an opportunity to push forth a fairly strong Democratic agenda, and I hope in an effort to appeal to and get both sides of the aisle to come together that we don't give up too many things, you know, in that sense. And we certainly need to be willing to fight for what we believe in, but we also have to come a little to the center on some issues, but
mm-hmm.
I hope we don't do that too much. And I think if we stick to our ideals and what people believe Democrats should be standing up for, I think we're very well positioned in 2008 for taking the White House back and maybe taking some other key Senate seats and congressional seats as well.
Yeah, I hope so. Is there anything else that really stood out about the election, or the topic of this show is really current events and the emotional impact they have? Is there anything that, when you hear that phrase, that jumps out at you that you'd like to state or discuss before we talk about other things about you?
Sure. No, not about me. I'm teasing. But when you opened the show and before I came on, you read a little bit of something that you had wrote, and I think it is important that the current events and what goes on really do impact people, and I hope that for many people there's a sudden lightness, there's a bit of hope now in changing things, and I think that's very, very empowering, and I hope that this new feeling is something that we can all hold on to, you know, because when you have a sense of hope, you treat yourself better, you treat other people better, you can get more things accomplished. And so I think it's really important, and I have noticed, you know, since Tuesday, for many people, there's been a shift. You know, there's just been a shift. There's a sense of hope and a sense that we can get something accomplished. And I'm glad you brought it up. And now I think our challenge is how do we kind of keep that feeling on those times when, you know, look, Congress is going to hit the wall on a number of issues and they're going to take some roads that I'm not going to agree with. And how do we still recognize, though, from God, from where we came just, you know, last year, we do still have that hope because there are people who are believing in some of the things that many of us believe in and want to see happen.
Mm-hmm. I think there are even some Republicans that are not devastated that the Congress shifted hands, because even I think there have been Republicans that also were not comfortable with the all the power being in one party's hands. And I think that there are a lot of people that like the fact that there's a division of power right now. And for checks and balances, I think that there are even some Republicans sighing a little bit more relief that things won't be as fundamentalist and extreme in how things get handled.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the Constitution, this government was based on checks and balances. And you know, they're important, and it's important that people have a way of talking about issues, disagreeing, coming up with better solutions that take into account everybody's needs as best as possible and move forward. And sometimes when you're trying to do something very different, it takes a series of pieces of legislation to get you to the ultimate goal. But if people are being dogmatic and if there is no checks and balance, if there's no need to try to talk to each other to figure out how to get there, then you actually don't get anywhere.
Right. I agree with that. So speaking about getting somewhere, let's talk about, you know, the basis of all this stuff is people's commitment to serving their community and their society as a whole, not just being self-serving or serving the people who only think like them. You're one of those people that has a commitment to serve, and you know, we've talked about, you know, you've been very clear in terms of the attitude that you have about why you do what you do, but you do so many things that have really been focused on the betterment of society. One of the things, as we talked about, is the LA Free Clinic. Talk about what the LA Free Clinic is. I know it's like the largest or one of the oldest in the country.
Yeah, it's an incredible organization. The Los Angeles Free Clinic is celebrating its 40th anniversary, and we are the oldest continuously operating free clinic in the country. And we provide free medical care, dental care, psychosocial counseling, HIV testing, health education, social services to the greater Los Angeles community. And it's really just an incredible organization. Since 1967 when it began, kind of our motto is health care is a right, not a privilege, and we live that every day.
Now, the people that come to the clinic, are they just destitute people?
No, you know, over the years, the folks who seek our services have certainly changed, and we certainly see still probably about 10% of the people we see are homeless folks, but about 90% of the people we see are what we call the working poor. You know, they're men and women working 2-3 jobs trying to make ends meet, and their jobs might, you know, don't have health insurance and they can't afford health insurance. They're working for people. There, some of them are small business owners themselves, and it's really sad that people are working as hard as they are and you know, can't afford the health care that they need.
So it really does fill that gap from the insured to the and the non-insured in terms of people who, you know, are working, are supporting families, do have income, but wouldn't necessarily get approved for social services from the government. But here is the LA Free Clinic that provides them the services that they need, so that they're not, you know, ending up on the streets because they got sick or because they're now bankrupt because of medical expenses.
Right, right. And the thing here in L.A. with, you know, cost of housing so high and so many things, but 90% of the folks we see actually live below 100% of poverty, which means that for a single person it's less than $9,000. For a family of four, it's around $17,000. So people are poor who are seeking our services. And for society's sake, you want people to be healthy, and you want kids to feel, you know, healthy so they can go to school, and you want people to be feeling healthy so they can go to work. So it makes good sense to provide medical care for everybody.
Yeah, definitely. And there are a number of clinics all over Los Angeles. It's not just one location. So you really are community-based, so that people don't have to travel miles to get the services, correct?
We have three clinics. We have three clinics in the Los Angeles area. And there are a number of other clinics that they're not the LA Free Clinic, but we belong to a clinic association. There are a number of clinics that do variations of what we do around Los Angeles, probably about 50 or 60 clinics in that sense. But our clinic is one of the few remaining free clinics. We don't charge for our services. Many of our clients make donations, and they're incredibly generous, but we don't charge for services. We believe, as we said, healthcare is a right, not a privilege, and we don't want someone to not get the care because they don't have the money in their pocket to pay for it.
So how do you keep the doors open?
We keep the doors open because we have an amazing group of supporters. We get government funding. We have about 64% of our budget is government funded through the County of Los Angeles, the state, some federal dollars, and many of the folks who we see do qualify for that funding. We depend on foundation support and individual support, and we have just an incredible group of people who support this organization. It's truly a privilege to work there, because I just experience people's generosity really on a daily basis. We have a big dinner happening next Monday, and a group of volunteers working so hard to ensure that people come to that dinner and make incredible contributions. And you know, it's really a community-based support that really keeps the Los Angeles Free Clinic going. And of every dollar we raise, 85 cents is going right to services. So it's something the community believes in. And between the government and our supporters and foundations and corporations, somehow we're able to pull together our budget. And we have a number of people who volunteer their services as well, and partnerships with first-class hospitals like Cedars-Sinai and Children's Hospital of Los Angeles and Kaiser Permanente, and many people working with us to help us provide those services.
So it's really, to me, it's really like what we call that trickle-down effect. I mean, any organization is only as good as its leaders and the people at the top. And when the people at the top have the integrity and the compassion and the kindness of heart and mind that someone like you has as a CEO, it has that snowball effect all the way down to the people who are answering the telephones at the clinics. And I really think that's important, that, you know, you're setting the tone, and your colleagues up on top there are setting the tone for the functioning of an organization that really has an exceptionally good reputation in the community.
Well, that's so nice to say, and you're right. I mean, it comes from myself and my co-CEO, Jeff Bouyer, and our board of directors and our fundraising board. And I will tell you, we had an all-staff meeting a month ago, and when we, you know, we always go around, everyone introduces themselves, and there's about 100 people in the room. And I said, okay, this time, tell me your name and tell me what, which of our sites you work at, but also say either why you work here or why you chose to apply for a job here. And, Stuart, it was so amazing because it is exactly what you said. Person after person said things like, well, I wanted to work at the LA Free Clinic because I know the good work they do. Mm-hmm. I work here because I want to give back. When I grew up, I didn't have health insurance, so I know how hard that is. I love the people I work with. I love the volunteers that are here. It's person after person after person. We were almost all crying by the end of the show. But it was so perfect. I mean, people work there, and yes, it's our job, and people need to make a living and support their families, but we choose to work in a place where we feel like we're making a difference.
Mm-hmm. So if someone wants to contribute to the LA Free Clinic, or find out more about it, or even get in touch with you via email, what's the website?
Our website is www.lafreeclinic.org, and we just kind of improved it. So it should be very easy to get in touch with me or make a contribution or learn more about our services.
Or if you live in a community out there that doesn't have a clinic like this, it is a really good model to take a look at if you're wanting to get something established. And I'm sure Abby and other people there will consult and guide you along the way to do something similar to what they've done with the LA Free Clinic.
We're always happy to do that. Always happy to help others. I'm a true believer that it's important to help people. You know, sometimes people say, you're not going to tell them your secrets, are you? Well, maybe not everything, but, you know, when you give out, it always comes back. It always comes back. And, you know, if you just really live your life like that, it's fine to tell your secrets, you know. And especially in communities that don't have it. And there's organizations all across this country that do variations of what we do, and I'm happy to hook people up so they can get the information they need.
Great. Now, I also want to remind my listeners that if you didn't get that information on the LA Free Clinic, and if it's easier for you just to remember that I have a website for the show, which is tellthetruthfaster.com. tellthetruthfaster.com, you'll get a link to the LA Free Clinic site. And within about a week, this show will be archived for forever and ever and ever on my site so that you can hear Abby speak and find out more about the issues about current events and the emotional impact it has. So with that being said, Abby, again, I know that you really squeezed this in tonight, and I really want to tell you how grateful I am that you were on the show tonight and joined us with your warmth as well as your insight. So thank you for joining us tonight.
Stuart, thank you for having me. You have a great weekend, and thanks for doing your show. You can tell it's making a difference for folks.
Thank you so much. And I want to thank all of you who are listening tonight. For the next 2 weeks, we're going to not be live on the air. There'll be some sports tournaments going on in Phoenix, and that will be broadcast. So I'll be back in 3 weeks with another live show, Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler on KXAM 1310 AM in Phoenix, Arizona. Thanks for listening. Have a safe and great weekend.